Congregation of the Lord Jesus Christ, brothers and sisters, some of you here, I would imagine, just based on how many people are here, would be the youngest in their family. I almost don't know if I should say that I'm the youngest myself, because right away a label gets put on people that are the youngest, I think. Spoiled, maybe, treated differently than everybody else. They get the good years of mom and dad. Mom and dad are so strict for the oldest, perhaps. There are other kind of maybe not as well-known benefits to being the youngest. I won't confirm or deny whether or not I was spoiled or not. But all the other siblings are older, and they go through certain experiences in life before you do, getting their license for the first time, figuring out more independence, going off to hang out with friends earlier than you do. And you see them explore, you see them adventure, you see them do certain things, and often they don't do things perfectly. It's kind of part of life. And being the youngest myself, I saw some of the things they did right, and I saw some of the things they did wrong. And in seeing that, you know what happens now when, your sibling isn't exactly paying attention when they're driving their vehicle as well as they should have when they have friends in the car. And well, there's a mistake they have to watch out for. When older siblings make mistakes, you can take that in, and you don't have to try the same experience again to know, oh, that's not good for you. That's not good for your bank account. That's not good for your long-term health. And the same thing can happen even as we have the scriptures here. We are, in that sense, the later generations of Christians who've watched many Christians go through life and make mistakes. And we don't always get everything that every Christian has done and learn from everything that a Christian has done, but we do have the opportunity, especially in the day that James was working. These were the first Christians. You could say they're almost like the oldest in the family, and they're determining what is to be done and what ought not to be done. What does it look like to live the Christian life now that Jesus Christ has come, and they're waiting for the day for him to come back, Judgment Day? And how do you interact with outsiders, both poor and rich? That can be a challenging thing. Do you go along with that? Do you try to grow an influence, or do you stay away? And different things happened in the early church, and we get to read about it, we get to learn from it, and grow from it, and take advantage of our position in church history. And so we're going to do that this afternoon by learning from James' warning to the wealthy. And in the book of James, the letter of James, he's very strong on a lot of points. But even in the strongest times, there's always something to go back to. You can go back to James 4, verse 6, which mentions that even though James humbles the people that he's writing to and how broken they are, how friendly with the world they are, and how basically how much they are enemies with God by the things that they're doing, James, when he gets them in a broken state, which he also does here, calling for people to weep and howl and be miserable, when he gets you in that state, that's when he says, but God gives more grace. And so even though there's going to be challenges as we read these verses and meditate on them, we'll also keep in mind that God gives more grace through this warning to the wealthy. And so we'll look at the warning itself and the lesson in that, and then there's also a lesson in why this warning had to come up in the first place in the second half of this text. So we'll start with the warning itself in verses 1 through 3. We don't necessarily know who James is writing to. Some scholars have said it's probably still the rich in the church. It seems like there's rich in the church from chapter 1. And chapter 2 mentions some partiality going on. People must be within the church in some way. But if you go on in verse 7 of chapter 5 here, basically James says, rich, these are terrible things that are going to happen to you. And then he says, be patient therefore, my brothers, until the coming of the Lord. It's almost as if the rich are doing this thing to the Christians. The rich are doing the bad things to the brothers in the Lord, and so he's writing to the brothers to comfort them almost. But we don't necessarily know for sure. It's just good to keep in mind that this is not necessarily Christians that James is speaking to. He at least is not treating them as such. He's writing to brothers differently than to them. With all that being said, though, there is a very severe call in verse 1. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Something bad is happening to the rich. And we see something of what that is in the next verses. Verse 2, your riches have rotted. Your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded. James probably isn't being literal here. I don't think rich people would walk around with garments that are moth-eaten. That wouldn't look too good. They'd probably just get their money out and buy some more garments that are better. They also wouldn't be that rich if their riches had rotted and their gold and silver had corroded. So what James is actually getting across here is basically they don't realize that these people are rich, but they might as well weep and howl now, because if you really think about it from the right perspective, this is the state of their riches. Their riches don't last. Their riches are basically rotted already. They don't have lasting value. It's very similar to what Jesus says. In fact, Jesus says similar words in Matthew chapter 6 that we read earlier. Don't lay up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. Right there is the problem. Riches don't last. These rich people have all this stuff. They've probably even worked hard for it. But it's not going to have lasting value for them. It might as well be in the state of decaying already. Why can James say that it's in that state already? Well, he has the right perspective on life that he's been trying to teach the Christians that he's writing to. He already talked about how things can change in an instant in the verses leading up to this, in verses 13 through 16, people boasting about spending a year here and trading and making a profit, but you don't know what tomorrow will bring. You who are rich, you have spent all this time kind of gathering wealth for yourself. You don't know what tomorrow could bring. Things could be gone in an instant. They don't actually have, those riches don't have as much value as you think. And knowing too, he's going to go on to mention this, aspects of judgment day that's going to come. The material things that these people might have, they might as well be rotting, because what are those things going to do when the day of slaughter comes, when the Lord of hosts brings justice to this world? These wealthy people should weep and wail now, because they're wasting their lives on what they're doing. All these things that they're working so hard for, their value is already going down before they've even used it. And how often doesn't that happen for people? They spend their life on something, they put their effort into something, and they're all out for it, they're going for it, only to realize when they get further down that path that, oh, this is not the thing I should have been spending all my effort and time on in the first place with. This is selfish, or this is just going to be valueless in a couple of years. They have that sometimes in life. I don't know if any of you have ever swam in an open water race before. Some people in our church have gone through triathlons or triathlons, and that, as they do it, you know, you go into the open water, and you have to go to a buoy and go around, and it can be chaotic. There's all kinds of people swimming around you, and it's hard to keep your sense of direction going. And some people actually end up going quite a ways off course. They have their head down for like a minute or 2 or 3 minutes even. I just got to get past this group that's thrashing around me here. And they look up and they've gone completely in the wrong direction, and they have to now go twice the distance that they went before in order to get back on track. They've put in all kinds of effort, probably more effort than the people that were just going steady on the path, but all for nothing. It was putting them further and further behind. And that's what life is like for people, according to James, who put all their effort and time into gaining material possessions, into enjoying the pleasures that this life has to offer. There's going to become a day when they pop their head up and look where they've gone and say, what was this all for? Why have I been going down this road? The broad way, rather than the narrow way that the Bible calls. James in verse 3 says, your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion, this is the second half of verse 3, will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have laid up treasure in the last days. That's, again, judgment language. It's like they're going to be sitting in the courts one day, and their gold and silver are going to somehow have life in them, and they're going to be testifying and showing where these people's hearts really were the whole time, not for heavenly treasure, but for earthly treasure. And God will say to these people, this is what you've been busy with. This is what you have to show for the time that I gave you on this earth. You spent all your effort on getting this. A famous sermon by John Piper, a speech that John Piper gave way back, a famous preacher in the States, back in the 80s, I believe, maybe early 90s, about seashells, and talking about retired people that spend their retirement collecting seashells. And he says at one point in that speech, they're going to come to Judgment Day, and God's going to say, what did you do with the time I gave you? We got seashells. Look at our seashells. Look at what we collected. God could say the same. You spent your effort on this. This is what you did with the time that I gave you in this world. If the realization that money and a bigger house and a nice vacation and nice clothes don't amount to much in the end, if that doesn't eat at you in this life and make you question where you're putting your effort now, then James is trying to say the stark reality is going to hit you eventually. It's gonna eat at you. Eat at your flesh like fire, he says. Judgment language again, like this morning on the Holy Spirit. And you're not going to be able to get through that fire. It's a strong word from the Lord here through his servant James. He wants us to realize that because these things are so easily in our lives and we get so easily caught up in them. If it isn't one thing, it's the other. If we see other people getting caught up with one thing, we learn from them, but then we dive headlong into another thing. And we're too busy being like, well, I'm not going to be like those people who spend way too much time on that, and we don't even spend time looking at what we're doing with our time, with our effort, where our budget is going. Maybe it's important sometimes to think about what it is that you do with any extra money that you get. Right? Maybe that hasn't happened for some of us, that we get a raise or a job promotion or the next big contract for our business. But for those of us that have had that, the new money comes in, we didn't have it before. How often does that money seemingly disappear into the things that, oh, I've always kind of wanted this, or I was getting along fine without that, but now we have room to get that. Let's go do that. What would happen if we just continue to live our lives with what we needed and not with the rest? And try to make sure that there aren't others in need by putting our efforts and our strength to support those who are in need. Because, of course, there are many all over. In our own communities, in our own church communities even, that either can't afford the counseling they need, they're not equipped with the right skills and routines to hold a job. What if our efforts went out ultimately to support the community, to strengthen the community, instead of stockpiling things for ourselves? James's lesson, it's clear here, riches are dangerously tempting, but hopelessly lacking in value. They can never pull it off. They can never make this life worth living. Don't spend your efforts going after the wrong things. They trap us. You look at the rich young ruler from Matthew 19, this would have been an up-and-coming elder basically maybe just somebody that looked like they were going to be so helpful for those who were working to please God, reading his Bible all the time, trying to do all the right things, obey the law to a T. Oh, look at how desirous this person is for the church, for the church community. They'd be doing so great. But their heart was in the completely wrong place. He was committed to a path that was going in the wrong direction. Jesus shows up and points out the fact that he's heading off this way with all his riches. He's too focused on what he has, and he's not willing to give it away. He asks him to, and he can't do it. He loved what he put his effort into too much. And even when Jesus says, well, that way is going to be valueless for you if you don't give it up and follow me, at that point he's too far off course. He's not willing to go back. The warning of James speaks directly to someone like that. You've laid up treasure in the last days. These are the days before Christ returns, and you're laying up the wrong kind of treasure that's just going to disappear on you, and you'll have nothing in front of the Lord. That's the lesson from the first three verses. There's also a lesson in the reason for this warning in the first place. Our second point, we turn to verse 4, and we see why James has been warning these rich people, why he's condemning them so harshly. They've been doing something in order to get rich. Maybe you could say they're doing something in order to keep getting more rich, because to do this, they would have had to be rich already. But verse 4 says it, "Behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you. And the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts." This is a classic bully, economically. The rich are cheating their workers of their pay and making sure in some fraudulent way that these poor people don't get the money that they deserve right away, which is actually a direct violation of a law from Leviticus 19, which is actually a chapter that James works with more often in his letter. And James 19 talks about doing what is good for your neighbor, not judging your neighbor. That came up in chapter 4. But Leviticus 19 also very specifically says, "The wages of a hired worker shall not remain with you all night until the morning." Which maybe we think, well, bosses do that all the time today. They give me the check at the end of the week. Sometimes it's a monthly check, depending on what kind of work you're in. It's up to the boss that way. Well, we also live in a society and an economy where that's just more expected, and you make plans that way, and the economy can handle that. People have larger amounts of capital to do that. In those days, in the days of Israel, it was not as easy for people to do this. There wasn't as big of a middle class. It was so much more important to give the pay the day of, because you couldn't just take out a loan or dip into your savings at the bank. A lot of rural people worked in the fields, and they could only get by on a pay every day kind of wage. And the wages themselves, James says, are crying out with injustice. They're sitting in your account there, and they're saying, "What are you doing? This is wrong. I should be with the person that deserves this." And God has heard these cries. Not just any God, the Lord of hosts, the Lord of armies, the Lord of heavenly armies has heard this call. You're not doing this in a hidden way. James points that out further. He says in verse 5, "You've lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You've fattened your hearts in the day of slaughter." Again, a graphic warning about judgment. The rich are living in a day and age that judgment has been warned is coming. No one knows the day or hour, but it's coming, and they have completely ignored this. They're not preparing themselves for it at all. Instead, they're actually just fattening themselves for slaughter. They're fattening themselves for the judgment by the things that they're doing. They're almost as oblivious as a pig on a farm that's eating more and more food that's placed in front of them, doesn't know that this is only so that the farmer can have a better meal, a bigger meal. It's strong language, but that's what life is like to those that don't believe, that reject God's grace and simply live for themselves in this life. It's a life that ends in judgment. That's one reason to take James's warning seriously. There's another one in James chapter 5, verse 6. You have condemned and murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you. So the only person that you should be worried about is God, because these righteous people that you're hurting are not doing anything about it. Mostly probably because they can't. Right? This is another example of basically bullying somebody that can't fight back. This was actually mentioned in passing in James chapter 2. When there was this favoring going on, James is saying, don't favor the rich and leave the poor man in a seat kind of off to the side. These are the same rich people that are oppressing you and dragging you into court, he says in chapter 2, verse 6. They're not doing anything for you, these rich people. Well, we find out they probably haven't murdered in the literal sense, but they might as well be murdering the poor by the way that they're treating them. Not paying them, fighting them in court, getting them condemned unjustly. The rich are basically starving the poor out, forcing them out of their means to live, so that they end up on the streets starving to death, and they can't get any food or they can't get anything to survive. And there's some obvious lessons here from what this has to do just with money and how we run our businesses. We're called to pay our laborers fairly and on time. We're not to use our capital or our money to our advantage and force other people under. Think of the kind of classic business model of some big businesses that, you know, come into a town and they undercut all the small businesses in town for a while, and then once those businesses close up, can't survive, then they can hike up the prices again because the competition's gone. That's an obvious one maybe, but we can do this in all kinds of slight, small ways, just in our small businesses and our closer relationships. Well, you know, that person won't be able to do very well if I put the price here, so we'll keep this, and they'll probably have to fade off into the background for a while, and I'll do well. We're not in business to crush competition. We're not trying to gain as much money for ourselves at the expense of others. We are not using the money that God has given us to take advantage of other people. That's not what we're meant to do. We're meant to use it morally, lovingly, to serve. And you can't just say, well, you know, this is the business world. It's a dog-eat-dog world. And, you know, the ethics in that, they're different in that area. Well, Jesus Christ did not die on the cross to save us just in terms of our private, personal lives. He died to redeem the world. He died to redeem the ethics of this world. There's not a square inch of this world and a square inch of any aspect of this world that he doesn't have some sort of claim over ethically. We need to follow his ways also in how we use our money and treat other people with our money as fairly as possible. Now maybe we can, a lot of us run businesses and we can say, well, we don't oppress the poor in this way. I pay fair wages to my employees. I don't try to pull business moves that are unethical. But it is so easy to slip into practices where you get, you know, that new employee to kind of go do this, and who are they to say no to the boss? Well, this is just the way we do things. And they're like, I don't know if we should be doing that. That's not really giving the customer what we said we were going to give them. The client's not going to know that we're doing a poor job here and kind of covering it over. Over and over and over again, there's opportunities to try sneak more money out of people than we deserve. There's general money lessons even in James' warning here and in why he's giving this warning. But even more than that, there's a general lesson to be learned. you can see how easy it is, really, when your efforts are full out, going for something earthly, something that doesn't last. You see how easy it is to become so selfish for those earthly treasures that you don't even realize, or you just don't care, that you're hurting other people, that you're even taking life away from them in some way. It doesn't have to be just money things. How often don't we hear that, oh, that person on the soccer field or that person on the ice rink is a different kind of person than we know them over here? Or that person, they're really nice in church, but when you see them in business, you'll watch out. We get so focused on material things, things that ultimately don't have lasting heavenly value, that we become different people. We lose sight of our Christian confession in order to get that earthly goal. That earthly goal takes priority. People, relationships, and ultimately God takes the back seat. Are we not in danger then of, instead of preparing God's kingdom for its full coming into this world, are we not in danger of fattening ourselves for the day of slaughter? At least ask yourself the question, why do you have to live so close to that line sometimes? Why not give yourself fully to the kingdom of God and His Christ? He has bought you completely. You confess that in the Heidelberg Catechism. You confess that when you stand up at the front of the church and do your profession of faith. I'm not my own. I belong body and soul to Jesus Christ. I'm His. Let Him use me. Not let me use my life for myself. And in fact, belonging to Him is exactly what should be the motivation for that, because what did He do in order to get you? He did not defraud people in order to get you. He did not oppress people in order to get you. He did not cause you any harm in order to get you. In fact, even though we're called His slaves, we're called His servants, what does He do for those that follow Him? He washes your feet. He supplies all that you need. He gives up His own life on the cross. He suffers for you the deepest shame and anguish of hell to pay for your sins against Him. And He says to you here, I am yours. Live for me and for my purposes. And as much as He's doing that for us still, we find it in our hearts, well, that's really nice and I thank you for that. But I am going to go off and do this now with my time. I'll serve you maybe on Sunday. I'll serve you for a little bit here and there in my day. But we can show through what we do and how we spend our time and money that we want a little bit of life for ourselves. Who actually lives like that, where they give themselves over to God? That's not realistic. But brothers and sisters, congregation, look back at Christians throughout history who were called to give up their lives as martyrs, who went into dangerous places knowing full well what it might cost them. They lived like that. Christians in the Middle East today don't know if they can trust to have a meal with their own family because they might get poisoned because they serve a different God. Their choice is clear. They can have life of comfort, good, easy relationships, a family that loves you, or they can have Christ, an imperfect church, and a life of uncertainty. And yet they know for sure which one they want. They don't want the easy life. It's not even a fair comparison to them. This is treasures on earth. This is things that don't last. This, Christ, and nothing else even. Just Christ would be the ultimate treasure in heaven. I don't need the other things. God warns us through His servant James to take stock of where our hearts are at, where our treasures are at, and whether we are indeed fattening ourselves for this world and nothing else. People didn't resist those rich people back in that day, but God was speaking into their lives here. And so also today, we might not always see it, and people might not always come up to us and say, hey, you're being unethical in this or in that. But God's calling you out through His word. to take a look at what you're doing, to steward your life so that it is more and more completely given over to His kingdom and His glory. And thankfully, again, as we hear James's warning, he wants those that are guilty to weep and to howl. But he also wanted people to weep and howl before, back in chapter 4, verse 9. He was speaking very clearly to Christians there. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves before the Lord. But it's there that God gives more grace. It's there when you realize that you haven't had a heart given over to God, that broken before Him. He will be gracious to you and through Jesus Christ even exalt you. So learn. Learn from the Christians in the past. Learn from the challenges the church went through in the past. Lean on God. Humble yourselves before Him and seek His grace, and He will be merciful and faithful. Amen.